Hi, this is Alan Chartok. Joining us today is Dr. Cynthia Stunkel, an endocrinologist at the University of California, San Diego, where she's clinical professor of medicine and a member of the Endocrine Society. Dr. Stunkel is a leading expert on metabolism, menopause, and diabetes, and researches heart disease and osteoporosis. Dr. Stunkel attended medical school at the University of Illinois in Chicago, completed her residency at the University of Chicago. Dr. Stunkel, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Alan.
I want to ask you first, Doctor, why we are having this humongous number of people with osteoporosis, both women and men in this country.
That's a very good question, because osteoporosis is something that's not often enough addressed. It's a silent thief, is how it's often referred to, kind of stealing bone quietly over time, and not really recognized until people experience a fracture of their hip or a fracture of their spine. Probably one of the most likely reasons is because of inadequate calcium ingestion in our youth when we're building our bones. And my personal thought, and I think that of many experts, is that if we worked harder to increase awareness about the importance of building strong bones in our children, in our teenagers, in our young adults, that we may see less of a problem down the line.
Okay, so what are the ways in which either immature people or mature people can strengthen their bones?
Well, immature people, which let's define what we mean
kids,
by that.
Kids,
I think we can be immature at any age, meaning, let's say, children, teens, and young adults, can focus on getting, number one, adequate calcium, and number two, adequate vitamin D in their diets. And probably if a person ingested, say, 3 glasses of skim milk a day, that'd be pretty close to a reasonable amount of ingestion. And for vitamin D, the amount in a standard one-a-day kind of vitamin, 400 to 800 international units per day, is probably also adequate.
Obviously, our kids aren't getting that.
Our kids probably give up milk. I mean, we think that particularly young girls give up milk in their teens and switch to diet sodas, which for the most part don't have calcium.
Do they leach calcium? Is there any indication, Doctor, that they leach calcium, in particularly the diet sodas?
There's some thoughts that the carbonation or the phosphates in the sodas might contribute to that. I think the other thing is that we need to talk about lifestyle and encourage people to exercise at any age. Exercise not only increases bone strength in our youth when we're building bone, but exercise also helps with balance, and having our sense of balance intact can help reduce falls in our later years. That's important. And then other lifestyle things like getting rid of the cigarettes. We know that smoking can decrease bone formation and inhibit strong bones in that way, and we know that excessive use of alcohol can also, as you asked earlier, leach calcium and lead to added calcium loss in the urine.
But there does seem to be an increase. One of the theses that people have advanced to me is that we do know that some of the medications that are on the market, widespread, for example, you know, the stuff that stops, you know, too much gas in the intestine or whatever, it becomes problematic.
I think specifically the family of medications that you're talking about would be related to those that decrease gastric or stomach acid. So people take it who have reflux or acid indigestion kind of thing. And we think that that may be linked because acid in our stomachs is very important for absorbing calcium. And we also know that as people age, the amount of acid in their stomachs can be reduced. And so there are certain kinds of calcium, calcium citrate, for example, versus calcium carbonate, which is the most common supplement that people use, might be better absorbed in folks with age or in folks who are known to have decreased stomach acid. Carbonate overall is very effective. But if people are known to have a reduced gastric acidity, then I think citrate is probably better absorbed.
Okay, so the Nexiums and things like that, are they causing us problems in an onset of osteoporosis?
I think there has been a link in some observational studies with the proton pump inhibitors, True. With possibly an increased risk of fracture, yes.
So I've heard that walking is actually a bone strengthener. Is that true?
Any exercise that increases load on the bone, so walking, running, increasing, being vertical, and somehow increasing the weight bearing of the bone can be helpful, yes.
So when you put your people on exercise who have osteoporosis, what do you tell them to do?
Well, I think walking is fine. I think people who have severe osteoporosis need to be careful that they don't aggravate their situation or lead to, you know, doing things that are too rigorous that could lead to falls or excessive bending or weight that would stress their spine, because sometimes these fractures can occur just at a very minimal amount of exercise. But I think walking is good for everyone. Walking is good not just for our bones. It's good for cardiovascular health. It's good for our mood. It's good for probably, you know, pumping the blood through the brain is good for thinking. So it's hard to argue with walking for anyone.
Tell me about osteopenia versus osteoporosis.
Yeah, this is a real important distinction. And the reason that these categories were originally established is to help us look both at the severity of the condition in a person and then help us decide who should be treated. So the way these categories were originally established depends on the bone measurement called bone density. And the best way we do that is through a machine called a DEXA, a dual X-ray absorptiometry. And this is a very low radiation, straightforward test that usually measures the thickness of our bones in the spine and in the hip. And then the measurement for an individual person is compared to the bone health of a healthy 30-year-old, for example, when we think that women would be, or men would be, at their peak bone density. And the result comes out to be something called a standard deviation, which just says how far from that normal are you. And so we know that if your bones are more than, if you're, is expressed as something called a T score, is what comes out on the report. If your T score is greater than minus 2.5, that says that you're 2.5 standard deviations below that healthy bone, that's a diagnosis of osteoporosis. Now, the next category that says your bones are thin, but they're not so severe to be called osteoporosis, has been called osteopenia, or the newer preferred terminology for this is low bone density. And these people have a measurement on their T-score of minus 1 to minus 2.5. And what that says is we have to kind of stroke our chin a little bit and say, okay, your bone density is somewhat compromised, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you require treatment. And what we're finding, Alan, can really help us decide whether or not that person with osteopenia or low bone density should have treatment would be a relatively new online questionnaire called the FRACS. It means a fracture assessment tool that asks about 10 questions and can help the healthcare provider, be it the physician or nurse practitioner, whoever, look at a person's 10-year risk of fracture and then with that information of the bone density plus this fracture risk, then make, I think, a much more educated recommendation as to whether or not that person needs therapy.
Well, of course, the more you talk, the more interested we all get in terms of where we're going with this. I think it's terrific. Dr. Stunkel, I guess the question I have now is, tell us some of the questions on the questionnaire, the FRAC questionnaire.
Yeah, it's really, if you know, your listeners are interested, this is something you can just Google, FRACS questionnaire, and this is something that's been used worldwide now and is actually customized for different countries because we know that risks are different. So it starts by asking about age, and we know that age is one of the most important risk factors, that if a woman has a certain bone density when she's 45 and she has that bone density when she's 85, she's going to be much more likely to fracture when she's older. So age is a question, sex is a question, The weight and height are questions because we know that something called the body mass index can be very important as a fracture risk. The questionnaire asks people, have you had a fracture before, meaning an osteoporotic fracture of the spine or the hip? And even, do you have a parent who fractured their hip? Because we know that there's some hereditary component. It asks about smoking. I mentioned earlier that smoking is a risk factor. It asks about the use of glucocorticoids like prednisone, for example, that people with rheumatoid arthritis, for example, or other conditions might need to take.
Now, those drugs are both killers and helpers. In the short run, they're great. In the long run, they're not so good, right?
It's really tough on bone. There's no question. Via a number of mechanisms, the glucocorticoids are tough on bones. But as you said, some people just need to take them. It asks if they have rheumatoid arthritis. It asks if they have any other conditions that contribute to osteoporosis. We know, for example, that excessive thyroid hormone can contribute to osteoporosis, certain disease states like multiple myeloma. So it says, do you have any reasons for secondary osteoporosis? It asks how much alcohol. Do you drink more than 3 units per day of alcohol?
Wait. More than 3 is bad, right?
More than 3 probably leads to excessive bone loss. And even if we look and you say, hey, but I've heard that there is other potential benefits for alcohol, even the American Heart says that women should try to limit alcohol ingestions to 1 drink a day, and it allows 2 for men.
So I guess I'm a little guy. I'm about 5'5", now going down, 70 years old, and my bones are fairly thin. They've always been thin. Give me the bad news. There are people, I have guys who work with me here whose arms seem to be as big as my leg. And
When you say thin bones, Alan, what do you mean? Do you mean you've had your bone density measured and it comes out on the low side?
Well, actually, the truth is yes. But that wasn't what I meant. I meant if you look at my arms, they're thin. And if you look at my friend's arms, they're thick. So are people who are born, obviously, the mesomorphs, with greater bone, are they less likely to get osteoporosis?
Yeah, probably, to some extent. Just because if you start with less, you've got less of a buffer zone.
Yeah, you got less.
We know that men lose bone gradually with age. We know women lose bone in an accelerated fashion in the years immediately following menopause and then continue on more gradually with age. But I think our awareness that osteoporosis can be an issue for men is something that's relatively new. But we're learning now that it is important in men, and it's something men are probably a little less likely to fracture than women. We say that up to 1 in 2 women will have an osteoporotic fracture sometime in their life.
Wow.
The number used for men is about 1 in 4, but we know that for men who do fracture, especially a hip fracture, that the mortality is higher in men than it seems to be in women, and the disability can be of concern as well. So when your wife takes her calcium, maybe men need to ask, gee, I wonder if I should be taking this too.
In our case, it worked the other way around. Nevertheless, I guess I have to ask you, why is it that when, you know, my doctor friends tell me that somebody fractured their hip and then they die, what is the relationship between death and fracturing a hip?
Mm-hmm. The likelihood of dying within a year after a hip fracture is about 1 in 4.
Wow.
That's pretty upsetting. It's not so much, you know, the broken bone doesn't kill you, but the disability does. So people who are confined to bed have more blood clots, they develop more respiratory infections, they develop more other kinds of complications and problems. So, and another quarter of people probably never function at the same level of independence that they did in the past. So, you know, this is a double whammy and really behooves us to try to, you know, avoid that first fracture because the consequences are so high.
A quarter of the people who may fracture a hip die. And could you just go over the reasons why that happens one more time?
When people suffer a hip fracture, they're certainly hospitalized. They often require surgery to repair it. They're often at an already advanced age and might have other concurrent medical conditions. And then just being immobilized, not able to move, and often at bed rest has its own set of risks. These can involve blood clots. These can involve infections with breathing, These can involve other kinds of infections just from being in the hospital. And so there isn't any one necessarily specific cause of death, but we just know that having the hip fracture and the disability associated with that increases mortality.
Okay, now, Dr. Stunkel, I ask this question. You've painted the gloomy picture, but if you have osteoporosis or if you have osteopenia, what do you do about it? I'm going to advance myself here and say there are a number of drugs, but some of them come with black boxes around them, meaning the warnings, and more and more research is showing that some of them have actually been counterproductive. Can you talk about that?
I would start by backing up a little bit, Alan, and saying that if a person has clear-cut osteoporosis, especially a person who has had a fracture of the spine or a fracture of the hip, the benefits of treatment with a bone drug far outweigh the risks.
Okay.
And so in that group, I think experts are very clear in agreement that treatment is recommended.
And what is that treatment?
Well, the most common treatments for osteoporosis involve a class of medication called bisphosphonates. This includes drugs like alendronate, risedronate. Those are given by mouth. A couple can be given by vein as well, ibandronate, zoledronate. And these drugs work by decreasing bone resorption. So they kind of just act on the cells called osteoclasts that resorb the bone, which leads to bone thinning, and they kind of shut those cells off. So these drugs have been evaluated in randomized controlled trials, the gold standard of scientific investigation, and have been shown to be very effective at reducing the risk of spine and hip fractures. I think they've gone through the appropriate evaluation to show that they work.
Now, some of these reclass drugs and others which people take, as I say, come with warnings from the FDA. What's that about?
There are warnings because it has been shown, and these are very rare, meaning a handful of cases per 10 or 100,000 people who are using these agents. And the two most widely, I would say, publicized or side effects that have been described in recent years are one condition is called osteonecrosis of the jaw, which is a mouthful for saying that these people can develop a small patch of dying bone in their jaw. The way that this looks to a person is that they might actually see a patch of bone, and there might be an area where the gum has thinned down to the point where this can be visible. And this is something that is serious, but can be treated. The particular people or the constellation of things that seem to lead to this, Alan, are not only the use of these drugs, but very often these are people who have had cancer, for example, who are getting very high doses of these drugs at a more frequent interval than an average person might. They often have had the use of steroids in the past or possibly chemotherapy. Though having said that, there have also been reports of this in just folks who are taking their tablet once a day or once a week or once a month for osteoporosis. So it can happen, but it's very, very rare.
Okay, so what else you got in your bag of tricks for somebody who has osteoporosis? You've told us not to smoke. You've told us to drink some milk when we were kids. what else you got?
Well, there are some other medications in addition to the bisphosphonate family. There's a medication called raloxifene, which has been out for some time. It doesn't appear to be quite as potent, but certainly for women who have osteoporosis without fractures or who have had maybe one vertebral fracture, raloxifene can prevent further vertebral fractures, and it also has the added benefit of preventing breast cancer. This is appealing to some women, and so I think that might be an added factor to consider when looking at the menu of agents for osteoporosis. And then I think the final category for folks who have very thin bones and have had multiple fractures is a medication that's given under the skin, much as one would give insulin, on a daily basis for a year and a half to 2 years, and that's called parathyroid hormone. And this agent can actually build the bone. We can actually follow the DEXA reading, the bone density test, and see that the bone can actually increase in strength. So there's a number of ways we can get at this problem. And then finally, there's one more new agent in the last year is called denosumab. And this agent works in a very clever way via kind of working with the body's own control mechanisms for these cells that digest, that absorb bone. So I think the important thing for folks to know is that they have choices, that there are options, and that these things, you know, take time, merit careful discussion, and maybe some back and forth as they course through this therapy.
Are you optimistic about helping people with osteoporosis?
Oh, I'm definitely optimistic, but I think that people have to take a stronger role at helping themselves because so many of these things, I think our society has traditionally been, you know, just give me the pill, doc. Just take care of this. And it's more work. It's more work to start young and to be careful about what we eat and how we exercise and avoiding things that can erode our bones. So the challenge is to kind of for folks to be proactive about this. Let me just say one other thing, Ellen.
Sure.
The statistics show that about two-thirds of Medicare patients, so people over 65, have even had their bone density measured. So, you know, come on. If you haven't had your bone density measured and you're over 65, that merits a conversation. And folks who have osteoporosis, even folks who've had fractures, aren't always treated. And so I think people need to be a little more proactive about that, too. Hey, let's get the right therapy going.
Hey, what about weight?
Weight is, you know, we walk this fine line as we kind of look at what our priorities are. A little bit of extra weight, especially in the hip region, which is something that plagues a lot of women after a certain time of life, probably actually adds a little extra padding or cushioning that can help prevent fracture when you fall. If we look at somebody who's got a strong family history of heart disease, though, we're going to really want that person, man or woman, to be as lean as possible because we know that's one of the best things we can do to prevent heart disease. So we kind of have to strike a middle road, Alan, where we, are careful about that. But weight, just as I said, any weight-bearing exercise is strong for the skeleton. Folks who are carrying around more weight probably in general have a higher bone density.
Have higher bone density if you have more weight, and yet the cardiologists tell us, you know, lose the weight.
Got to strike a middle road.
Well, I'm going to ask you that. I'm going to follow that up because in an age of specialization, you go to see your cardiologist, you go to see your endocrine person, and they tell you what you just told us, and you find sometime that the specialists give you different answers. For example, your gastroenterologist may tell you, look, in order to prevent getting some kind of a terrible disease of your esophagus, you should probably take this pill. And yet, as you indicated before, there is some studies which indicate that people who take Nexiums and other things put themselves for the bone loss at a greater risk.
Yeah, I think this involves individualization, a careful assessment of an individual's risks and benefits that are currently being assessed. I mean, esophageal cancer can be one of the results of having chronic acid reflux. So certainly a person wants to avoid that. But also, sometimes folks will begin these therapies and continue them for years instead of a course of a few weeks or months. And so, again, I think on an individual basis, that gastroenterologist might say, look, by lowering your gastric acidity, you may not absorb calcium as well. So we want to make sure that you're one of the people who would be better off on calcium citrate. And by the way, let's have a look at your bone density right now and see where we're starting from and make sure that we take any other measures that are necessary to strengthen your bones.
But it is so easy to say, you know, that this has to be a matter of choice on the part of the patient and the rest of it. But, you know, what do we know? We just got a docs and they tell us what to do.
Yeah,
and
I think that is unfair to just say that people need to fully make these decisions themselves. I'm in agreement with you on that completely.
The pros have got to tell us to do that. So, Dr. Stunkel, I guess the advice of, you know, losing weight, which we hear almost universally from doctors, and then you're telling us, hey, a little extra padding probably hurts and probably your bone density may be a little bit greater. That's one of those classic dilemmas that we have.
I would say I'd go for the heart because I'd go for, you know, our society is so plagued with obesity at this time. It's absolutely terrifying. The other sequelae of obesity include increased diabetes, increased cancer, in addition to increased heart attacks and vascular disease. So my vote would be, I don't want anyone who's listening to us today, Alan, to say, I'm not going to lose any weight. It's good for my bones. I mean, check out where your bones are. But in general, the vast majority of people in our society would benefit from being leaner.
Talk to me about women, menopause, and osteoporosis.
Oh, I'd love to talk to you about women and menopause. Well, certainly, as we've been discussing osteoporosis, we know that, again, women can lose bone in an accelerated way immediately following the menopause. So it's good to, again, start high, and then you have a buffer for some loss. And we know that women currently bear the brunt of osteoporotic fractures, just more common in women than men. We know that women who elect to use estrogen if they have symptoms of menopause will get the added benefit of hanging onto their bone density during the time that they use the estrogen. But once that women stop it, that added benefit to the bone will no longer be maintained. So again, it's when women are thinking about, gee, what am I going to do at the time of menopause? I think that a number of these factors need to be considered. But again, one has to look very carefully at her individual situation, symptoms, risks, concerns, et cetera, before making any kind of recommendations.
So what are you telling your patients about estrogen?
I tell women that estrogen is the most effective therapy that we have for relieving symptoms of hot flashes and vaginal dryness. But I tell them that it's certainly not the only option that we have for treatment of symptoms, and that, again, it's very important to look at their individual risks and benefits. One of the things that the Endocrine Society has done, Alan, is to come up with an online, interactive, kind of first-of-its-kind tool that women can go through at the time of menopause or anticipating menopause. And it asks some questions about their symptoms, about their past history, their family history, and kind of walks them through what some of the options might be for symptom relief if they need it.
How do they get that tool?
Yeah, you can just go online, hormone.org. It's called the Menopause Map, and it's kind of fun. You can go through one way, then you can say, you know what, I'm going to change my answers and see what I get, so you can try it another way. You can say, well, maybe I would try this, and then see how the answers stack up. And it also provides a couple things. One, it gives women a printout of their answers, because I think sometimes it can be challenging for women to work through this conversation with their doctors. And so we hope that this will not only get women thinking about it, but sort of say, hey, I did this menopause map and had these questions, and I'm wondering, you know, what might be best for me. It includes some questions and answers specifically that they can print off and take with them to their doctor. And it also includes a host of just resources because, Alan, there's a lot of stuff out there on the Internet that isn't necessarily evidence-based.
So I would say.
It includes links to Endocrine Society resources, North American Menopause Society resources, American College of OBGYN, the American Heart, the National Osteoporosis Foundation. And these are all very, you know, well-vetted, evidence-based kind of options for women to just learn more about whatever interests them.
We are talking to Dr. Cynthia Stunkel, an endocrinologist at the University of California, San Diego, where she is clinical professor of medicine and a member of the Endocrine Society. So going back to menopause for a moment, Dr. Stunkel, I always like to ask doctors these questions, and I hope you don't take offense, but have you made up your mind when that time comes for you what you're going to do about estrogen?
I will re-say, Alan, that I think these are very individualized decisions based on a woman's symptoms. I mean, not everybody has symptoms during menopause. And some women sail through this and kind of say, what's all the fuss about? So I don't want to terrify anyone that, oh my gosh, I'm going to have to make a decision. They might not. I think it depends on what their family history is. And if your mother and your aunt and your sister all have breast cancer, you're probably going to take a different route than in a family who hasn't had those kind of concerns. And similarly, I think looking at your heart health and risks for that can also be important to consider. So the other thing, Ellen, I think I always advise women is you can look at this today, you can think about it today, but we have to stay tuned because we keep learning more about this. It helps us refine our recommendations.
In fact, we went through this huge thing with estrogen. Everybody stopped, or what seemed like everybody at the time, because it looked bad. And now there's been some increasing evidence that maybe it isn't so bad. We go in cycles.
Well, we sort of go in cycles, but I would just defend and say that I think what you're referring to is that in 2002, so already a decade ago, a large clinical trial that was federally funded called the Women's Health Initiative reported its very first results. And the results of the Women's Health Initiative were that for women taking hormone therapy with the idea that it would be used for preventing heart disease and osteoporosis, among other things, that it did not seem that the risks were worth any observed benefits. And so the issue with the WHI, which is how we abbreviate this, was that hormone therapy did not appear to be effective for prevention. That was a really important thing to learn because many of us, for a decade or more prior to that, were encouraging really all women, unless they had a strong medical reason not to take hormone therapy, what we call contraindications. We thought everybody should take it because it would be good for them. And so this was important to find that out. But what I think happened over that time was that in some instances, I think the baby got thrown out with the bathwater, such that both women and their doctors started backing off of hormone therapy even as a treatment for symptom relief. And so, Alan, in these last years, what's happened is I think we've had a chance to follow these women for up to 11 years now, and to look more closely at the risks and benefits in women by age group, because the original results included women from age 50 up to 80. And so now our current thinking on hormone therapy is that for women in their 50s or within 10 years of menopause, that there are some risks, but they're very small, and that if women really are suffering and not sleeping and having real issues with hot flashes, that using hormone therapy for a number of years is probably a very reasonable choice.
Wow. So are people who got off of it coming to you and saying, should I take another look at this?
Well, that does come up. We learned when the original results came out between 2002 and, say, 2004, that lots of women, as you mentioned, Alan, did just stop cold turkey and say, yikes, this is scary. I'm going to not take this stuff.
Sure.
And probably about one in four of those women came back and said, I can't stand it. My symptoms are still driving me crazy. I want to take it. The other thing that we've done in this decade to refine how we use hormone therapy is we're using doses, for example, that are only about half of that we used to recommend. So,
do they work?
They can work. They can take a little longer. So instead of seeing results right away, it might take women even a couple months to see an improvement. But I think they work. And women don't necessarily need for their hot flushes to be completely eradicated, completely wiped out. They sometimes just need to have them improved. So I think, you know, we're looking at a degree of benefit. The other thing that's going on is we're looking more at other therapies. The Women's Health Initiative tested primarily oral pills. There are other avenues that women can use hormone therapy in the way of patches or gels or sprays. And in certain instances, some of those are being evaluated as well. So I think that, again, there is quite, as with the bone health, there's quite a menu of choices. And it's important that women know that these exist. The menopause map spells that out. But, again, it has to be an individualized decision.
Let's go to diabetes. This is one of your big things. I mean, we can't even begin to have enough endocrinology people in this country because we have this massive diabetes issue now. And I'm wondering what the relationship between diabetes and osteoporosis are.
Well, that's a very interesting question because when we say diabetes, we have to be very specific and specify which diabetes we're talking about. Are we talking about what we call a type 1 diabetic, which is someone who usually develops diabetes at a young age, which is characterized by their body just
sure.
stopping making insulin? Or are we talking about something that we call a type 2 diabetic, which is more often a person who is of older age, obese, and whose body makes insulin, but is just overwhelmed such that it's just not functioning adequately to control their blood sugar.
Actually, I'm talking, Dr. Stunkel, about type 2 diabetes, which seems to be the epidemic. Or are we having an epidemic in type 1 also?
I think type 2 is definitely the epidemic, and we're even seeing type 2 that used to be, as I said, someone of advanced age and old and higher weight in children and in teens. So there's no question that this is epidemic proportions. The data that we have to date would suggest that there might be a somewhat higher risk of fracture even in type 2 diabetics. I don't think we understand exactly what the mechanism of that might be, whether the high blood sugar affects the quality of the bone that's put down or, you know, what specific is going on. Because often if we measure the bone density in these folks, it looks pretty good. But it just tells us, it kind of reminds us, Alan, that we don't understand everything about bone strength, bone architecture, bone health, because we can still see, to some extent, an increase in fractures in these folks with type 2 diabetes.
Okay, so let's just switch to diabetes in general here. Let me ask you this. Do we know why we have this epidemic?
To the best of my understanding, it's directly linked with the diabetes epidemic. I don't know if you've had a chance to go. You sound like a person who looks into a lot of these things, Alan.
I've done a lot of these interviews mostly because, you know, I'm sort of paranoid about the whole thing.
The CDC down in Atlanta puts out a map every year,
right.
And it shows the evolution of overweight and obesity in our society by just increasing the colors. So 25 years ago, you know, the U.S. map is all like pale blue, which means no one's obese. And by now we're looking at a map with, I don't know, between, it looks like a third to a half of it in bright orange. So it's pretty interesting to see this evolution, and it's been fast. And so to the best of my awareness, the diabetes epidemic is directly linked with the obesity epidemic.
Interesting. I do know several people who are quite thin who have diabetes, type 2 diabetes, and they would fall outside that category. Nobody in their family seems to have had it.
Yeah, I think we clearly there's much work and much research going on with causes of diabetes and vulnerability to diabetes. But in general, in the vast majority, it's linked with weight. There certainly are exceptions, as you're mentioning.
When I was a young man, I had some friends who had diabetes. They're dead. They got blind. They died. That's not happening the same way now because we have so many diabetics who have better chances because of the advances we've made. Can you tell us about some of those?
The menu for treatment is dramatically expanded and has gone from agents that work in very different ways to control blood sugar or to control the way that insulin affects blood sugar in the cells. way beyond the use of insulin. And so I think that these added medications and the variety of these medications and some of the sophisticated ways that additional hormones, particularly some of the additional hormones made in the fat. I mean, we've learned, Alan, that fat is not just kind of something inert there on your body, but that fat really has a life of its own as another endocrine organ, has been quite quite exciting. And then the other thing are for the type 1s, Alan, like some of the friends that you may have described, we're just more aggressive. We give younger teens insulin pumps. We're much more aggressive at controlling their blood glucose, and this seems to be helpful at reducing certainly some of the effects of blindness and kidney disease. So I think it's if a person has diabetes, it's a very hopeful time.
What's an insulin pump?
An insulin pump is, it's a very small device, like a cell phone, and a person connected a small, it has a reservoir in it, a space to store insulin. There's a small tube connected to a needle that's placed in the skin, usually in the abdomen, and in the abdominal fat wall, and the insulin is released at a very steady state, and then the person has the option to say, "Oh, I'm going to lunch now. I'm going to take a little added insulin before I eat my lunch." So they can kind of program that into their pump and take their bolus of insulin and control the calories that they're eating at lunch. And maybe their dinner is a little later than they planned, so they don't take their insulin until they need it. And so this ability to, you know, get the insulin more in tune with your lifestyle, I think, has been very liberating for type 1 diabetics, and also, again, gives them much better control.
Do we have something coming? We've talked about the Jarvik heart. Do we have anything like an automatic pump so that the individual doesn't have to do the work?
Well, the link in this automatic, and research is certainly undergoing in this, Alan, but the link is that currently the person tests their blood sugar, because you need to know what your blood sugar is in order to know how much insulin you need. And so the missing link, or the link that's being worked on, is something called a glucose sensor. And there are some advances that have come along in this, such that this machine is smart enough to say, okay, right now your blood sugar is 200, so you need this much insulin. Right now your blood sugar is 75, so maybe you don't need very much at all, and to give some feedback like that. So that would be the magic. And then the other magic would be progress with actually taking the insulin-producing cells from a pancreas and being able to, you know, implant those in a person, so it's all happening the way Mother Nature wanted it to happen. And so, you know, that's another area of active investigation. And
that's very exciting. I mean, here you are, professor at the University of California. You're up on the latest. There aren't enough endocrinologists in the country. Obviously, primary docs are doing a lot of this work. How long does it take to get an innovation from you guys down to them?
Oh, I heard a number recently about this. I'm not sure I can answer that exactly, Alan, but I think that the important thing is education, education, education. Mm-hmm. And there are many, many programs, because I think we all appreciate that. I mean, same with menopause. Not everyone needs a menopause expert, mm-hmm. for heaven's sake. Certainly primary care physicians, nurse practitioners, OBGYNs, family practice doctors are skilled for the vast majority of patients in these areas. And similarly with diabetes, this is a very commonly discussed topic at the medical meetings and journal articles and online internet learning. And so I think there are many opportunities. And I think in general, folks should be, fairly optimistic that their doctors should be up to date. I mean, the question is, you know, when does someone need to see a specialist? And that's, you know, when things aren't going so well. And, you know, again, that can be on an individual basis. Someone's either not communicating well, or you're just not getting better, not getting relief. You know, then that might be a time when it would make sense to get a second opinion.
Now, I assume you have a clinical practice, right, in addition to your professorship?
I do primarily in a teaching setting.
Right. Is it heartbreaking for you when you see somebody who's over the top on this stuff?
Well, I think in any endeavor, you mean over the top in that...
Well, it looks like that there's some real problems. You said they come to you or come to the experts when there are real problems. And I take it some of these problems are unsolvable. I mean, if you get a woman who comes in and she's 450 pounds and she's not going to lose that weight and you know it, and she's got diabetic problems and she's got endocrine problems of one kind or another, how do you as a physician, does it break your heart?
Well, I think it's like the old serenity prayer, Alan, where we try to recognize, you know, what we can change, what we can't change, how to know the difference. But I think that the really important issue is that for many of these kind of healthcare concerns, particularly diabetes, that we need a team. And most institutions will have a diabetes team. So this includes not just the practitioner, but also a nutritionist and maybe an exercise person and a link to appropriate eye evaluation and then a link to appropriate kidney evaluation if that's necessary, maybe physical therapy. So the team approach is really critical for helping folks take these on because these are, you know, having something like diabetes affects really, you know, every aspect of your life. Hmm. So you've got to, I think you have to get as much help as you can. And I think that's really the way to make this happen.
So you just mentioned the word kidneys. It was actually where I was going next. There are lots of organs. You've just talked about, you know, having a team. But now we have kidney specialists. We have heart specialists. We have, you know, we have diabetes specialists. The patient really can't manage their own care. You're at a great university medical center. What happens to the other people?
Well, really, for I think again, Ellen, the way things are going in our healthcare system, as we realize that these resources are really important to be available, is that the really successful programs, and say a managed care program like a Kaiser, for example, would involve something called a case manager or a patient advocate, or, you know, they have different, the labels are different, but the idea being that there are people who help coordinate all these different requirements, visits, appointments, whatever, to help folks work through the system in the best way they can. So I think as we look to, you know, making the most of our healthcare dollars and making the most of health so we can have long, high-quality lives, these team approaches, again, which can be very untraditional when we think, you know, just going in and seeing the doctor and taking care of everything, I think these team approaches are going to be really important. There are teams doing osteoporosis care for the same reason, and certainly cancer centers have teams. So I think, you know, more and more we're moving to this as the way of the future.
So tell me about kidneys for a moment. Why are they always brought up when we have these discussions?
The same small vessel disease that can affect the eyes in a diabetic can also affect the small vessels in the kidney. And so it's not uncommon for someone whose diabetes control has been poor to develop a compromise in their kidney function.
How do they tell it? I mean, how do they know they've got kidney disease?
Well, we can do two things. One, we can do a urine test, and we can measure for protein in their urine, because a kidney that's being affected by diabetes might start to leak some protein. The other thing we can do is measure a blood test called a creatinine, which is a measure of kidney function. And if we see that start to increase, that might be another hint that the kidney is being compromised.
So why is protein, when it gets in the urine, important?
Well, it's important because, number one, it's a sign. Initially, there's not necessarily so much of a negative effect of this, but if the protein leak becomes very high, we need protein in our bodies to maintain kind of our fluid balance, and so people might develop problems with swelling or something called edema if they have a very, very low amount of protein in their blood because they're leaking so much in the urine.
Is it potentially fatal? If the protein goes unchecked, what's the consequence?
I would think that there would be other concerns with compromised ability of the kidneys to filter waste and issues related to that above and beyond the loss of protein that would be most threatening to the individual.
Mm-hmm. This has been a fascinating hour with you, and I thank you so much for all the time you're giving us. But if you were to sum it all up, is our healthcare system right now equipped to do these wonderful things you've said? So, for example, you just talked about team managers. Well, I think there are a lot of people around here, at least on this coast, who are shrugging and saying, what's that? How do I get one for myself? Do you see a time coming in America when we can really do healthcare the right way?
Well, I sincerely hope so. I think in the meantime, Alan, the main thing that every one of us can do, you know, when we look at some of the issues in healthcare reform and some of the plans that are potentially discussed, my husband, who's a doctor as well, and I both just say, you know, the main thing that we can do is do everything in our power to hang on to our good health now. And for your listeners, I would suggest that, you know, again, there are no magic bullets, Alan. It's the tough stuff. Eat well, exercise, get sleep, throw away the cigarettes, you know, moderation in the alcohol. Take the medicines you're prescribed. If you have high blood pressure, high cholesterol, or, you know, on the road to a hip fracture, you know, apply what we've got available. But again, right now, I think every person needs to be, you know, really responsible and meet that challenge that they have to do the best they can for their own health.
Well, our guest has been Dr. Cynthia Stunkel, an endocrinologist at the University of California, San Diego, where she's clinical professor of medicine and a member of the Endocrine Society. Dr. Stunkel, thank you so much for spending all of this time with us. I know how the lines must be formed outside your office, and we do appreciate it. You've helped an awful lot of us to understand what's going on here. Thank you so much.
Alan, I thank you for your thoughtful questions.
Been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org.